The Guardian.
The NHS is going to be kind of open to privatisation now. If private companies can provide things like hip operations, hernia operations in mass, they'll be able to do that cheaply. They'll be sold off, which means we will only get experience of kind of what's left for the NHS.
Well, I certainly think that we need a lot more public awareness because it's all been done by stealth. The general public haven't seen an uproar in the media and we really need to see that.
As a doctor, you want the best for your patient. And if you're also having to make distribution decisions, which are going to mean that some of your patients don't get what they need, it's clearly a conflict of interest and it's not feasible to do as a member of a caring profession.
Well, whether you think the overhaul of the health service is a modernisation, as the government says, or a wrecking tactic like those student nurses we just heard from, there's one thing everyone agrees on. This is shock therapy, the most radical overhaul in the service's history. This is Politics Weekly with me, Tom Clark.
And me, Anne Perkins. In this week's podcast, we'll look at the future of the NHS, what these changes mean for the service, and what's at stake politically.
Joining us to discuss it, we have The Guardian's columnist Madeleine Bunting.
And the former Lib Dem MP and a man who knows the NHS from the inside, Evan Harris. Welcome to you both. Well, it was on this subject of the health service reorganisation that Ed Miliband chose to attack at this week's session of Prime Minister's Questions.
I'll tell him why nobody trusts what he says about the NHS. What did he used to say about NHS reorganisations? There will be no more pointless top-down reorganisations that aim for change but instead bring chaos. It is profoundly disruptive and demoralising. Mr. Speaker, I agree with what the Prime Minister used to say. Why doesn't he?
We're not reorganising the bureaucracy of the NHS. We are abolishing the bureaucracy of the NHS.
The government argues that these reforms will cut red tape, increase choice, and put more power in the hands of popular doctors while abolishing unpopular managers in the primary care trusts. But critics say that we'll soon see wide disparities in the quality of care around the country. Our producer, Phil Maynard, put this to the Health Minister, Simon Burns.
No, I think it'll do the exact opposite, frankly, because you'll have the National Commissioning Board, which will be working with commissioners through the consortia, which will give a greater consistency. You'll have NICE providing over 150 guidelines on individual medical episodes and conditions, and you will also have the local communities far more involved through the health and wellbeing boards, through Health Watch, and in addition to that, the involvement of democratically elected individuals in the shape of local councillors, who of course will be a key component of the health and wellbeing boards.
So this bill will give a lot more power to GPs, but will it also give them the chance to get a lot richer personally?
No, of course it won't. What GPs will be focused on is providing the best quality care for their patients. They will get a sum of money per patient per year towards their administrative costs. Any savings in the administration budget can only be spent on commissioning, so that they can save money from that budget that will then go into the commissioning budget to enhance the money they already have for commissioning patient care, not going into their pockets, as some people erroneously have suggested.
So that is definitely wrong, is it? That GPs can't just set up their own companies and then, in effect, commission themselves to provide these services and take a profit from that?
Not in the crude way that you are suggesting. Or the statement suggests. There are circumstances, as there are now, where some types of care or medical episodes are provided by GPs, but what you have seen, or what you see in the legislation, is that there are protections there, so there are not going to be conflicts of interest, and the National Commissioning Board and Monitor will be issuing guidance to make sure that in circumstances where doctors also have a provision of certain types of healthcare, that there is not the propensity for them to have a conflict of interest and abuse the system.
And finally, you've said that these measures will allow patients an unprecedented choice in the care they get. If a patient prefers a reputable hospital over a cheaper one from a new provider and a cheaper treatment from one from a new provider, can they make that choice?
Well, the question is based on a mistaken statement. It's not a question of playing one hospital off against another on price, because the competition we envisage in the reforms is competition on quality, not on price. And so you won't have that situation, because if a private provider or a private hospital is going to provide services for patients, then they will be paid exactly the same amount as the NHS hospital will through the national tariff or the negotiated arrangements for hospital or patient care where there isn't a national tariff. So it's not a question of playing one hospital off against another on price. That is factually incorrect and a misconception that some people are peddling.
So there we have it from Simon Burns, the Health Minister. More power for doctors, more choice for patients and fewer pen pushers. Why, Evan Harris, were you shaking your head through the start of that interview?
Well, I don't think Simon Burns necessarily understands his own legislation, but the issue that Liberal Democrats like me have, and I think almost all Liberal Democrats, because it was an overwhelming vote about this, is twofold. Firstly, that some of these reforms were not in the coalition agreement. So not just not Liberal Democrat policy, but were not in the coalition agreement that we voted for. So we're not bound by it. And secondly, and combined with that, some of the things actually breach the coalition agreement. And then we have views as Liberal Democrats shared by the BMA, in fact, on Tuesday of this week, that some of these reforms are actually damaging, both in terms of accountability and the over-marketisation of the health service.
But what exactly is it that you think is the weakest point of these reforms?
Well, it's hard to pick one, but
pick
one
three.
Of the one of the real problems. It may well be that price competition has been dealt with or will be dealt with by the government, because that's what they say. So let's leave that aside, and they're going to rule out competition on price.
So that's the hospital price wars. You're not so worried about that anymore.
I'm still worried, but I'm more confident that that will be sorted, because the government's put an amendment down. It declares it solves it, and therefore it looks like they're intending to deal with that. Whether the amendment that's down actually does that fully is an issue. That's why we said completely rule out competition on price in our amendment. But let's take cherry picking, which is another thing that's been talked of. That is either private providers coming in and taking the best patients, and if the payment is on outcomes, how well patients do, then there's a huge incentive to select your patients carefully and not take the difficult ones. That leaves, at the same price, the NHS service, which has to be there for the emergencies, the complex cases, the training, the research and the rescue of disasters that may happen anywhere, with the harder or more difficult patients. And that means that they're going to not be able to meet their costs by doing so. And there's no clear provision in the bill at the moment for that not to be allowed. And the second thing, exactly analogous, is the cherry-picking of whole services. If all elective work is taken away from the NHS, then the NHS will find it impossible to train the doctors unless the doctors are taken away to have training done, and that means the rotas for the emergencies are under threat. And indeed, if those elective services, which are predictable and predictable income, are taken away, then you're left with much greater risk being borne, even if there is adequate, in theory, financial reward for the complex cases and the emergencies. So that's the real danger of destabilisation. And we use the term no destabilisation, no undermining and no fragmentation of services. Not ruling out private provision, but having those three safeguards in place.
But it seems unavoidable. Health inflation, ageing population downward pressure on public spending means you have got to find a way of delivering what the government says it wants to deliver through this, which is ever-improving patient care while managing to hold the costs down.
Yeah, I mean, the government says part of the government's plan is to take a lot of savings from what it calls bureaucracy out of the health service and reinvest it in the front line. In other words, to generate growth in frontline spending, even though there's barely any growth, small, barely any growth in real terms funding, despite the pressures that you quite rightly mentioned. Now, that's a separate issue. People say, and maybe that can be done. It's not clear to me that it can be done very effectively if you are creating more primary care or more GP commissioning groups than you had PCTs, unless you cap their costs, which is what they're planning to do. If you cap their costs, they may not make very good, very wise commissioning decisions which may cost money in the long run. But let's give the government the benefit of the doubt, which I'm always willing to do, and they can deliver these. It's going to be extremely hard to have wholesale reorganisation at a time of trying to sweat these assets. So a lot of experts have said, do one or the other, reorganise or drive massive efficiencies. But doing both at the same time is managerially foolish and politically, particularly for the Conservatives and by extension to the Liberal Democrats, disastrous. The Conservatives are not trusted on the NHS, so they'd be best off in their first term leaving it alone. And Liberal Democrats should certainly not identify themselves with the retoxification of the Tory brand on this issue. Politically, the decision's even worse than the policy.
Madeleine?
Well, I completely agree with you on that point. I think the politics here are reckless. But it's an incredibly technical debate, and it's extremely easy, because health is such an emotional issue, it's extremely easy to conjure up panic and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So we've been running stories recently, doctors can make loads of money out of this, hospitals are going to be closed. These are about the most emotional issues you can get in politics. So the politics of are reckless. It's extremely hard to understand what they're talking about. You can hear the minister, just that we had a bit earlier, sounding so tetchy, because you've got this wrong, you've got that wrong, is what he's been saying. He was
There's going to be no crude ripping off, implying there might be some non-crude ripping off.
Well, absolutely, but he kept talking about that's a misconception, that's factually incorrect. They're very frustrated that they can't get the message across. And for people like me, who just, you know, deeply attached to my local GP, blah, blah, you know, the idea that you can abolish bureaucracy or vastly reduce it is, it seems to me, a very repetitive political argument that we've had dozens and dozens of times, and again, it's failed. You don't actually, it's not as easy to cut bureaucracy as people keep saying.
But what do you, I mean, you say you trust your local GP. What Andrew Lansley is saying, and one of the few things he says that isn't disputed by many people, is that the GPs are going to have more sway here over hospitals because they'll have the money.
What I want my GP to be able to do is concentrate on patient care. I think there are big bureaucratic burdens to organising healthcare. I don't want my GP to be doing them. I want my GP to be absolutely focused on the relationship with the patient and the medical clinical priorities. So it seems to me that that bureaucratic burden of organising a huge health service has got to be done by someone. It's either the primary care trust or it's some new bureaucracy which will emerge in GPs commissioning. I mean, basically, we're just transferring a whole bunch of civil servants, presumably, from one set of institutions into another.
That's certainly true. If you agree that GPs ought to have more of a say on commissioning, it can be done without reorganisation. In fact, under the last government, there were things called practice-based commissioning, where GPs were able to have a say in commissioning, even though they weren't the legal budget holders. I was at the BMA special representative meeting all day on Tuesday, hearing GPs and others discuss this. And there will be some entrepreneurial GPs who'll want to do this. But most GPs either will be full-time on that and therefore won't be seeing patients anymore, or will not be involved in it and will be seeing patients and won't have any influence. And the conflict of interest point has not been addressed by the government, because either you say you will not be able to purchase services from yourself to avoid profiteering, but if you say you're not allowed to do that, then maybe the best service, which is the one you would have offered, is not one you're able to buy. That's why the purchaser-provider split, introduced by Mrs. Thatcher, was actually a wise thing to do in public services, because it does avoid that, particularly when there's a wide range of providers.
And then restituted in the primary care trust, and then taken away again. So, I mean, one of the extraordinary things, as Madeleine was kind of hinting about the whole health politics of the NHS, is how circular the argument is, and how every new lot of politicians who come in appear to have learned nothing from their predecessors.
We thought we'd had a win, because the coalition agreement said no more top-down reorganisations of the health service, and I rejoiced when I saw that, because I thought, at least, you know, given the controversy of being in a coalition with the Conservatives, which is challenging, and I guess they might have thought the same, that would be a good thing, some quietude in healthcare. But if you just look at the coalition agreement, there's certain things that I think you can't oppose as a Liberal Democrat, because they're in the coalition agreement. So, for example, GPs being involved in commissioning, it's in there. So I don't think we can fight that. Similarly, the creation of an independent NHS board, that's the National Commissioning Board, similarly. So we're not arguing in our amendment at conference for the whole bill to go. And I think Labour would be unwise to do that, because many of the reforms, as Alan Milburn said, build on theirs. But what is clear is that when the coalition agreement says we will ensure that there is a stronger voice for patients locally through directly elected individuals, there's none of them, on the boards of their local primary care trust being abolished. That's a gross breach of the coalition agreement. How can you whip Liberal Democrat MPs against our policy, our manifesto policy, and the coalition agreement all in one go? At the report stage of this bill, there are going to have to be amendments.
Can I just ask you quickly about the medical politics of this? I mean, the BMA actually did initially make quite kind of encouraging noises about this kind of reform, didn't it? And has only recently become the most outspoken critic.
Well, the BMA constructively engaged, but as more and more information came about the reforms, the membership told them that they needed to, well, actually on Tuesday they said continue to constructively engage, but in a more aggressive way. They ruled out restricting the BMA to opposing the whole bill, and they didn't vote for a motion of no confidence in Andrew Lansley. So there is now going to be a much more physical, if you like, or assertive opposition to the measures and calling for amendments. And actually many of the amendments, not by design, but I think this is why it's reassuring, many of the amendments called for by the BMA match the amendments called for by the Liberal Democrats, match the amendments called for, or the criticisms made, if I can put it more subtly, by the King's Fund, and indeed match some of the amendments already suggested by the Labour Party in opposition. So I think they're never going to get this through the Lords. I think they may as well deal with it in the Commons.
What about the impact on the coalition?
Well, I think there's a crisis brewing if I'm really sure of this, if they make Liberal Democrat parliamentarians, they whip them to vote against Liberal Democrat conference policy. It's the one thing our party has as what keeps us together is the fact that we're democratic. Against coalition agreement, which we voted for in May, and against the conference policy, then there will be a crisis. There will be rebellions, a very large rebellion, but the fact that they've done that, they've whipped MPs outside of the coalition agreement against something we've just decided, is not something that the party would tolerate, and it will come back at our next conference, and there will be trouble. I mean, it was a very friendly, good-natured debate. Paul Burstow is the health minister, is a popular guy in the party, but hell hath no fury. Forget tuition fees, like a party conference scorned on something that it has called for outside of the coalition agreement.
Madeleine, is your sense that this is the thing that could see the whole coalition unravel? Do you think the Lib Dems are sufficiently fed up in sufficient number?
Well, Evan is telling us that that's the case.
Only if the concessions aren't made.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what I find sort of baffling is what is the political calculation here? That they can afford to be quite so reckless with the coalition's sort of politics. And perhaps that the electorate will have kind of got used to it and got over it by the time of the next election. Because, what we've noticed already about this government is that it is quite reckless and it's quite prone to making mistakes, quite big mistakes. And it's had to kind of backtrack on several things in the last couple of months. So one wonders, you know, quite what the calculation here is and whether they've miscalculated because, you know, they had to backtrack on forests. And I reckon local hospitals kicks into the same kind of local constituencies. Yeah. So, you know, they could end up with an enormous kind of political upheaval on their hands. And, you know, the Tories have tried to do this before and they did backtrack before. They pulled out of these kinds of health reforms, 15, nearly 20 years ago.
And I think, Madeleine, what's interesting, particularly maybe for the Liberal Democrats, but also for lots of shrewd Conservatives, including David Cameron, is this campaign against the closure of a local hospital is such a kind of surefire winner with the local electorate. The Lansley proposition seems to be, we'll take politicians out of it, we'll let market forces decide, and therefore we'll absolve politicians of responsibility. But the political culture isn't ready for that, is it?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, this is one of the characteristics about all kinds of ways in which market capitalism tries to evade responsibility. All kinds of outsourcing and contracting is ultimately about trying to avoid responsibility. You know, it's not me, it's the market that decides. But it just doesn't wash in the end, and certainly not on health. Health is one of the most kind of political of issues, and you can't dodge that. You know, Polly Toynbee reporting from Germany, you know, the political arguments about health are just as vociferous in Germany, and that's about an ageing population with very high health needs and growing, and very assertive and a strong sense of post-war entitlement. You know, they're the kids of the welfare state generation.
So I agree with that. I just want to come back to something Madeleine said earlier. I think it's correct that this government has admitted mistakes, but the contrast with the previous government is that it has admitted mistakes, OK? The large majority governments of Blair and Brown just didn't admit their errors and, you know, illegal wars and so forth followed from that. And I actually think, and I take every opportunity to say this, that we should applaud politicians when they, inverted commas, U-turn, backtrack, all these weak negative terms, when they are persuaded or the evidence changes, because the alternative is for stubbornly carrying on. And I think we should applaud that. I certainly did in the rare occasions when my Labour opponents did in the last three parliaments. And I just hope the media start realising that we'd get better governance if it wasn't seen so negative, that people listened and changed.
Possibly also an interesting open door for Ed Miliband, who sounded very good on it in Prime Minister's Questions yesterday. I mean, perhaps the shiniest bit of the Labour record is the health service. But there we have to end that very interesting discussion. There's lots more on the bill as it makes its way through Parliament on our website at guardian.co.uk/health.
Now, bear with me as I tell you that it's no longer St Patrick's Day 2011, but is instead St Patrick's Day 1976. Royal Frolic is looking good for the Cheltenham Gold Cup, but away from the races, all eyes are instead on Downing Street, where Harold Wilson has just shocked the nation by resigning. And, Anne Perkins, I gather from you that the great political dreamer Michael Foot is about to become Prime Minister. What are you blithering on about?
This is one of the best games you can play among political nerds, which is who should have been Prime Minister and what difference would they make. And I've just contributed one of about 15 essays to a fine little volume called The Prime Ministers That Never Were, Bite Back Publishers. And my scenario, a popular one among contributors who were interested in how you might have subverted Thatcherism, how else you might have got out of the economic and social chaos of the late 1970s. My scenario is that Michael Foot beats Jim Callaghan, tipped on the front page of The Guardian exactly 35 years ago, odds on for Callaghan, Foot manages to scrape home after Healey intervenes in favour of Callaghan and makes people think that the right is going to try to exterminate the left from the Labour Party. And it turns out, unexpectedly, to be the most effective Prime Minister, a terrific conciliator and also a terrific campaigner. He leaves Healey to deal with the economy. He doesn't let him come back to conference and make that awful speech and get howled down. And he keeps Jenkins in the party by making him Foreign Secretary. And Shirley Williams takes over and wins the 1979 election.
Why did she take over if it's going so well?
Well, Foote decides to retire because he wants to write more books, obviously.
So, in other words, the best Prime Minister is Shirley Williams, not Michael Foote. He just helps Shirley get there.
Can I just say that, I mean, you mentioned him in passing, my political hero, Roy Jenkins, would have been a superb Prime Minister, as he was a superb Home Secretary. And had he had power in the Labour Party in the last few decades, certainly, you know, until
but
his
Roy
death,
never built
he would have prevented
basis
the anti-civil libertarian...
Well,
that may be so, but he, I don't think we'd have had the anti-civil libertarian Labour Party that we had in the late 90s and the early 2000s. We'd have had a fair electoral system, as Labour promised in 1997 but didn't deliver. So, I'm grateful to him for the mentoring he gave me, but he was just, if you just read everything he wrote and what he stood for as the reforming Home Secretary, you've got to applaud it.
The interesting thing about writing these sort of little games is trying to think how history might have been different. I mean, Madeleine Evan, can either of you think of a moment when history could have just been kind of slightly knocked off its axis? How could Roy Jenkins have won an election in the Labour Party? You know, I don't know quite who you, Madeleine, would most like to have seen as Prime Minister, but how might it have happened?
Well, remind me, who was standing against Margaret Thatcher in 75?
Well, initially Heath, and then...
Willie Whitelaw.
And then in the second round, it was Willie Whitelaw...
Because if that was the, you know, that was the real outsider coming through. Nobody expected Thatcher to get it. And you just think, well, you know, given the enormous impact that she's had on shaping this country, what if she hadn't got it? What if Willie Whitelaw had carried on a much more sort of one nation tourism, much more similar to Heath? Thatcher could easily have got terribly frustrated and gone rather sort of bizarre and, you know.
I think she probably would have been a loyal cabinet minister. I mean, you know, she'd shown, you know, the right wing, the sort of fundamentalist approach that developed through the 80s, I don't think was absolutely dominant in the late 1970s. I think it could have been contained.
I mean, the other nearly ran thing was the result of the Labour Party leadership, where I think it was Healey, wasn't it, who just beat Tony Benn and loved Tony Benn as I do, for the deputy leadership, and had Ben won, then there would have been an even bigger defection to the SDP, and then the SDP presumably within the alliance would have had the extra 1.5% to overtake Labour in 1983, and things would have been, I think, very different.
So do you think then that Labour was basically incapable of being saved in the 1970s? I mean, because, you know, lots of Labour people would say if that social democratic sort of critical mass hadn't left, then Labour itself would have you know, become electable that much more quickly.
Well, it's just, I mean, we're the same age, so it's before my time too.
That's very generous of you.
Well, indeed. So, I was playing chess and doing O levels at the time, but in that order. But I think you have to trust the judgment of the people, the senior people like Rogers, Owen, Williams, and Jenkins, who made that decision. It must have been a huge, burning, tearing thing for them to, particularly the Labour Party in those days, which was a family, for them to have done it. So in the end, I think one has to trust their judgment that they didn't think it was possible and they took a huge risk. And I think they knew they were taking a huge risk.
I think it was, you know, I mean, obviously the balance of that judgment, I totally agree, was a really, really difficult one. But, you know, in hindsight, it split the social democratic force in this country, and I'm not sure we've ever recovered it.
Madeline, you know, I mean, we've got here from Lord Halifax to Norman Tebbit, people who put forward as people who could have been Prime Minister. Is there anyone you think would have made a difference who wasn't Prime Minister and should have been?
Well, you know, just that argument about how could social democracy have survived the 70s and 80s when effectively it was destroyed.
Essentially, you had to win that 79 election. Because then North Sea oil starts to come in, you know, the profits from North Sea oil.
Yeah, but either 79 or 83. Those were the two elections that one or other of those you needed to get. And, you know, I've always thought Dennis Healey was, you know, was an incredibly impressive guy with many different kinds of political skills to reach to those different parts of the Labour constituency, which is, you know, a very disparate bunch. But he does, you know, he does the kind of union links as
but
well.
But, I mean, General Galtieri, it is said, lost the 1983 election for the Labour Party. I mean, I actually think William Hague, who now may well be past his prime, as it were, was such an effective speaker that what happened to him in 2001 was somewhat unfair. I mean, I don't think it was unjustified, given the position of the Conservative Party and their policy platform. But if he ends up never being Prime Minister, I think we will miss out. And indeed, if his star is waning, which isn't necessarily the case, then I think we will have missed out on an engaging, albeit someone I don't agree with, an engaging personality as Prime Minister.
Well, he's not in this list, but neither are any women, which is what strikes me, because an awful lot of the people down history who haven't been Prime Minister, in fact, all of them apart from one haven't been Prime Minister, are women.
So, Anne, what would it have taken for Barbara Castle to end
or
up?
Shirley either, yeah.
Well, particularly I think Barbara, you know.
Yes. But, I mean, there was a moment when Barbara was in the cabinet and before In Place of Strife, when, you know, people felt that she might make it, and she'd really changed. She'd really kind of identified herself as a new kind of politician. You know, having been this rather strident left winger and a woman to boot, you know, she'd really begun to establish the idea that a woman could be and a left winger could be a very, very effective minister and a very, very good communicator. You know, whether it had come to the nitty gritty, whether, you know, she did alienate as many people as loved her, whether she could have wooed the wider public, difficult. I think Shirley, who I think much more than Barbara felt in some curious way, as she's on the record as saying that, you know, she wasn't kind of quite good enough. Maybe that's what one of the most engaging things about Shirley, that slightly self-effacing manner. I think she.
But men don't have that quality,
which men
do they?
Don't have. Because of that quality, I think Shirley could really have changed the whole nature of certainly of gender politics in this country, and possibly of politics. And I think perhaps her decision, never putting herself forward for the top, is perhaps.
And the tragedy, part of the tragedy of Mrs. Thatcher, is its effect on feminist causes, because it was so not a step forward for women's rights. Yet there was this figurehead, and that's, in many ways, well, probably not the most damaging, but one of the sad things about the Thatcher premiership was that it possibly put back the cause.
That's something we could talk about for at least another half hour, and I'd really like to, but it's all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much to Evan Harris and to Madeline Bunting. I'm Anne Perkins. He's Tom Clark, and our producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.